Hey, it's Joe. What if everything you've been told about eating enough fuel for your training is only half the story? Most of us treat a calorie deficit as a threat, something that costs you muscle, saps your performance, and leaves you weaker. And if you want to build muscle or recover hard, you're told you need a calorie surplus. But here's the trap that catches so many of us, especially as we get older. If you're always in a surplus to recover and grow, you're not just adding muscle, you're adding fat. My guest today is Dr. Jose Arreta. He offers a reframe that I think changes the whole conversation. He argues that we should stop thinking about an energy deficit and start thinking about energy stress. And the distinction matters because stress isn't inherently bad. Exercise is a stress. We don't avoid it. We expose ourselves to it deliberately, progressively, because the body adapts and becomes back stronger. Dr. Arreta explores a genuinely provocative possibility that under energy stress, the body doesn't shrink, it adapts. It becomes more metabolically flexible, more efficient, even building muscle that's stronger for its size rather than simply bigger. For those of us who want to perform well and stay lean and live a long, healthy life, this reframe is more than academic. It's the key to a practical puzzle. How do you use calorie deficits to manage body fat without sacrificing performance and the muscle and the recovery you need? How do you balance the surplus you need to build against the deficit you need to stay lean? That's what we get into today. I think you'll come away thinking about hunger and fueling and adaptation differently than you ever have. All right, let's talk to Dr. Jose Arreta. Dr. Jose Arreta, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Hi, Joe. Thank you for having me here. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I understand you're an athlete, a coach of athletes, and a researcher on topics important to athletes. Well, I'm very happy to have you.
Yeah, no, that's I've been involved in sport, I think, all my life, you know, in different ways. And I think my curiosity has driven me to try to learn more and understand how our bodies adapt to exercise and how nutrition plays a role in that adaptive process. So I've experienced it from many different angles, of course, as an athlete myself. I'd say more like retired now as an athlete, but still very, very active. To, you know, coaching people, to do nutrition for individuals, for teams, and so on. And all that overlaid with my interest in understanding the sort of the basic physiology, metabolism, and sort of endocrinology to exercise and nutrition. So, yeah, that's the combo that I bring.
Awesome. Some stuff that I've read about you, let me mention, because these will be words that people will recognize, and then I'll give you a chance to tell us about more about your work. You've done research into how carbohydrates, protein, fat, energy availability, not sure what that means exactly, and ketones, how it shapes exercise adaptations and can boost performance. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, great. Okay, so I'm looking forward to knowing a little bit more about that, maybe some high points, maybe you've got some secrets that you're going to share with us. But mostly, today, I want to talk about this thing, which you've kind of blown my mind with on other talks you've given, called energy stress. So we'll get into that in just a moment. Tell us a bit about your work and some, you know, high points of some stuff you've learned on these nutritional elements.
Yeah, so I'll give you a little bit of background about myself. So I'm originally from Argentina, trained as a biologist over there, and then I specialized in the whole area of exercise nutrition throughout my PhD, which was conducted in Australia. I was at RMIT University in Melbourne, and sort of going back and forth between there and the Australian Institute of Sport, where I did a lot of sort of data collection and so on with actual participants there. Throughout my PhD and afterwards, I sort of been working for the last over 15 years in understanding how exercise and sort of training adaptations can be manipulated by, or can be optimized by, manipulating the carbohydrate, fat, protein intake, as well as sort of energy balance and energy deficit. What role those sort of energetic states play in training adaptation? And I've also worked after that. PhD training in Australia, did a 3-year postdoc at the Norwegian School of Sport Sciences around this topic as well. I did a lot of work on understanding how exercise has an effect on muscle glycogen concentration, And so how that can also maybe modulate the adaptive response to exercise. And, you know, it's been 8 years now since I've been in the UK. I'm based at Liverpool John Moores University here, where I, you know, lead and conduct research also in these topics. Over the last few years, I've been doing more and more work in sort of the effects of energy deficit on training adaptation, trying to understand, you know, what happens to our bodies when we put it in a state of energy deficit. That while sort of keeping on sort of producing research and new knowledge in relation to the other topics that I've been working for the you know, last whatever over a decade and so on. So at the moment I count with like nearly 60 scientific publications in, you know, a well-regarded scientific journal. So I've got a lot of experience in like understanding, you know, what happens to your body and, you know, how nutrition plays a key role in modulating that adaptive response, sort of backed up by all that sort of scientific research that we understand from others and that we produce as well.
And so you're talking about what we eat as well as how much we eat and the effect that variations of those variables has an effect on us. I know we only have a little bit of time together, and I really want to focus on this energy stress, which I think relates to the, you know, how much you're eating versus how much you're burning. But I'm curious just to kind of get some high points on, you know, like the fat based diets, like ketogenic diets for athletes. That was a rage. People thought that was the secret to success, and it sort of has fallen by the wayside. And people are, you know, and even before that, it was always thought, you know, oh, you got to power the carbs, you know, to have the energy for, especially for endurance exercise. And more lately, it's been the protein. You got to have a lot of protein, you know, especially if you're older. Is there any, you know, high points that you'd point to on these macronutrient variables for athletes?
Yeah, so I suppose that each of these topics could lend to hours and hours of podcast recordings and, you know, having conversations about all sorts of different things. In my view, there are like fashions that come and go, you know, and this has happened through the history of nutrition and sports nutrition. A lot of it happens because there's maybe not the highest quality research in some areas and people misinterpret some bits of information and then extrapolate, you know, findings in like small studies and so on. Or there's a misunderstanding of basic sort of metabolism, or some people interpret one thing from the sort of the evidence and then they think that that is the actual truth when that's a very sort of maybe it might be a study that was conducted like or badly conducted or conducted in a sort of a cohort that, you know, had specific characteristics and so on. So I think that, you know, generally speaking, there's no shortcut to do things well. And I think what that we need to be aware of is that the basics of sports nutrition haven't really changed a lot over, you know, the last few decades. Of course, there's always progress and we understand a lot of things better, particularly, you know, mechanisms, and there's been a lot of optimization and so on. But I think one of the reasons why these sort of fashions and crazes come up is because maybe people go, now it cannot be that sort of boring, sort of simple thing is actually going to make the difference. And, you know, a lot of the time when we work with athletes, we see that they just don't get right the basics. And, you know, we can maybe give suggestions of like very sort of complex approaches to nutrition and training. And like, you know, you say like, oh, we're going to periodize carbohydrate and train low and so on and all these things. And a lot of the time they don't have knowledge or they have the knowledge, but in practice, they don't do the basic things that would actually allow them to train harder and adapt better to training.
So if I'm reading you right, it's the extreme diets are probably not better than balanced diets. Is that kind of a good conclusion?
Yeah, I mean, you could say so. I think there's a lot of emotional attachment to specific diets. And I think a lot of the time they work more like religions. You see, you have a belief on like why you should do this diet and you think it's better than others, but and then I feel people get a bit biased at interpreting information that might oppose what they are saying. And it's similar to sometimes like political beliefs, or like maybe being part of a football team or something like that. You just like you might have more like an emotional attachment to something rather than being able to objectively understand the evidence and take decisions based on what the data are saying.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's jump into energy stress. I heard you talk about this. It was a 2025 study that you and your team did on the effect of athletes doing vigorous exercise while in a dramatic calorie deficit. And you looked at a bunch of different, you know, physiological factors just to see what was really going on inside the body. And I have to say that I was not that surprised by your findings personally, because I've done that sort of thing and had those, I thought I had those kind of results from it. So it seemed, you know, true to me that, you know, your science agreed with my personal experience. And so that makes it even more powerful to me. But you had sort of recharacterized the idea of a calorie deficit into an idea of a energy stress. And you really got my mind turning on that. And so that's what I want to spend the rest of our time talking about here today. But can we start by you just describing to our audience this study, and what did you do and what did you learn?
Yeah, I think before we jump into that specific study, which you're referring to a study that got published in the FASEB journal, which is a sort of high impact journal in this area, but it's more around the molecular mechanisms of skeletal muscle adaptation to energy deficit and exercise. I think it would be good to give a little bit of background for your audience, you know, and why this might be a hot topic, and, you know, the context in which we are studying this.
Yeah.
You know, we've done a series of studies in different type of athletes, you know, from athletes that do weight making, like combat sports, and they need to drop a quite significant amount of weight over the course of like 10 weeks, let's say they need to drop like, you know, 8 to 10 kilos of body weight in like 10 weeks and then fight.
Yeah. So not lose their physical capabilities after having lost so much weight.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, we have a case study report for a male athlete, like a combat sports. It's a taekwondo athlete that needed to make the 63 kilo category from like around 73 kilos, and you know, from in around 10 weeks, this athlete makes weight for competition. He wins the competition, and we see improvements in VO2 max and, you know, strength throughout that period. So showing that the athlete can clearly sort of adapt and perform at a high level despite a sort of very significant energy deficit.
And let me understand, you're saying he actually got fitter while he was losing the weight?
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. But you know, it's the thing is that we need to be aware that the body is quite complex, and because of our biology, our body doesn't really like to lose weight or lose energy in any form. So there's this whole range of endocrine and, you know, behavioral responses to energy deficit that make that people, you know, there's certain physiological systems that might get altered. And if you have, you know, if you stress the body for a prolonged period of time with, you know, with a degree of energy deficit, that might have a negative effect. In fact, you know, for that particular athlete, and we typically see this in combat sports athletes, they tend to have like a sort of hyperphagia, you know, after that period, they eat a lot and their body weight sort of comes back to where it was at the beginning. So we know that it's not particularly hard to drop weight, it's hard to keep it off. And, you know, anyone who have maybe tried to lose weight, they know that's the case. But, you know, the point here being that the body can still adapt very much so to energy deficit while, you know, there's a training stimulus. And similarly, you know, done a case report on a female Tour de France athlete a couple of years ago, was the first sort of analysis of a female Tour de France athlete in competition, showing like a pronounced body weight loss of like, you know, 2 kilos over the course of the 8 days of competition. But, you know, the performance was not affected throughout the race. And, you know, the best power output of the athlete was actually by the end of the race, when the athlete was like lighter and under what it appeared to be a chronic energy deficit because of, you know, some endocrine markers and definitely an acute energy deficit because of the weight loss and the difference between the energy expenditure and the energy intake that we measured in the athlete. So in this context, you know, it seems that athletes can actually adapt to training and perform in a degree of energy deficit. And why this is a hot topic at the minute is because there's this model in sports nutrition that is called the relative energy deficiency in sport that you might have heard of, and the female athlete trial and the sort of the male athlete trial. And these are theoretical models that propose that low energy availability, which, you know, is kind of a different way of calling energy deficit. You know, there's difference in the definition, but to make it easier to you and your audience, energy deficit and low energy availability are, you know, for practical purposes here, are about the same, so as not to make things more complex. So in these models, low energy availability is poised as a single factor that results in a whole range of endocrine and physiological dysregulations that ultimately affect the health and performance of the athlete. There is, you know, a degree of evidence to support some of these claims, but particularly for the RETS model, there's a lot of conclusions that are being drawn with out there being like very, very strong evidence to show causality between the energy deficit and the actual sort of dysregulation of the, you know, of the physiology and psychology of the athlete. So we've been rather, critical of this model by a year or so ago. We published a well-regarded review in this topic, showing the limitations and maybe the biases in the analysis of this model by saying that, you know, well, energy deficit seems to do something, you know, in terms of endocrinology and physiology, but between that and concluding that it has all these negative effects in a whole range of different physiological systems, we cannot really say that for now. And, you know, because athletes live in sort of multi-stressor environments, it's very, very difficult to isolate the effect of energy deficit and say, well, this is energy deficit and energy deficit only. And we propose that we should probably be approaching whatever problems the athlete have with a more of an open mind in what it's called an allostatic load model, where we consider a lot of different stressors that the athlete is exposed to, like, you know, psychological stressors and training and sleep and so on, with energy deficit being one of them. And that probably gives you a better picture of, you know, how different things are affecting the athlete. So in that context, you know, that study that we conducted in terms of like that sort of like narrative, that's the story that it fits with what we were trying to look into in this study. I mean, the thing is that the study, we looked into like so many things that it could be interpreted more from the what happens to the body with exercise and energy deficit in a sort of trained population, or we can also think about what are the potential sort of physiological effects in muscle that might be related to like health span and lifespan and so on. So there's different ways in which this study can be interpreted, and, you know, what angle you want to take, it depends on what conversation you want to have, Joe.
Well, you know, the audience here are athletes, and so they are interested in performance, but they're older athletes, and so they're interested in longevity and maybe being an athlete for a long time, long into a long lifespan. So the idea of finding another way to improve health and athletic performance is interesting to us. And so this idea that even though a chronic energy deficiency is perhaps possibly negative. People are constantly short of energy and the body is constantly having to shut things down in order to not starve to death. And it's turning off processes of the body that are important to the long-term health, you know, bone formation and whatever. Okay, that makes sense. But what I think I hear you saying is that, but that doesn't mean that an energy shortage for 5 days is bad for the body, you know, an acute energy shortage. And so, you know, this might be another tool that an older athlete might use to find health. I mean, we've been hearing about fasting and training glycogen depleted and things like that for a long time. But there's always been this worry that, oh, if I'm fasting or if I'm exercising with not enough energy, I'm going to be cannibalizing my muscles. And, you know, I don't want to do that. Or, you know, another thing that comes up in my mind a lot is, oh, I need to be in a calorie surplus in order to build muscle. I've been told this 1,000 times, whether it's true or not, is one of the questions. But if I'm in a calorie surplus all the time, well, I'm getting fat, aren't I? You know, I'm not just building muscle. I'm adding body fat when I'm adding muscle. So when am I going to have a calorie deficit in order to balance out this calorie surplus? And if I'm in a calorie deficit, aren't I losing the muscles that I just went to a lot of effort to build? Anyway, so this whole idea of having these short-term energy stresses that don't cost me athletic performance and athletic performance infrastructure, my muscles, my bones, things like that, is very interesting to me. You know, in addition to maybe it turns out that I don't have to have a calorie surplus, you know, or hardly any surplus in order to get stronger. All of these things, I think, have come from this study of yours. So anyway, that's my answer to your question.
Cool. So look, whether, you know, long-term energy deficit has negative or positive effects, it depends how, I think, how it's conducted, you know, and how severe the energy deficit is, and what population you're working with as well. I think that any kind of like reckless weight loss intervention is probably not the best. And, you know, when we are working with a combat sport athlete, that's quite extreme. I'm not trying to say that's a sort of healthy thing to do or that's best for your health or anything like that. But, you know, I'm going to put this in context a little bit by maybe making reference to some key studies that were not in humans and then moved towards sort of the human populations and what this might mean for your listeners and for sort of more masters athletes or like older population that, you know, exercises is active and they want to stay healthy. So as you probably know, one of the concerns of weight loss typically is that, I mean, people don't only lose weight from fat mass, which is generally what's desired, but they also lose weight from muscle mass. And there's this idea that by losing muscle mass, there's a decrease in sort of functionality of the muscle and sort of general capacity to be active and perform. So there are some studies on monkeys, you know, some macaque monkeys that, you know, they tend to live, you know, around 40 years old and so on, that are relatively good models for trying to understand what happens with like chronic energy restriction, that have shown that, you know, monkeys that are calorie restricted for many years, or like just like lifelong calorie restriction, tend to be, you know, more active and more healthy than the monkeys that are provided a sort of ad libitum diet, you know, and this is just a sort of a dietary intervention in these monkeys. And interestingly, even though they tend to be like smaller, you know, that their muscle, when they look at, they do the analysis of the characteristics of the muscle, the monkeys that have been calorie restricted for the whole life show a better quality of that muscle. So the age one of the characteristics of the aged muscle is to have this fibrotic tissue like collagen in the muscle. So you see you have inclusions of fat and collagen in a muscle that has aged. But the monkeys that have been calorie restricted seem to maintain the quality of the muscle without those inclusions of collagen and fat, suggesting that, you know, there is not just that they weren't like sarcopenic, so they lost muscle mass, but the muscle mass maintained the quality. So that if you look at the sort of the cross-sectional area of the muscle maintains that like a better quality. And related to that as well, there's an increase in markers of like mitochondrial biogenesis. So mitochondria are quite important organelles that generate energy in muscle. I mean, they do a lot of things, but typically they are known for that. And they seem to be key for a healthy muscle. So it seems that caloric restriction might be having an effect on keeping mitochondria healthy. Now, in these monkeys, there was no exercise intervention. They were not being made to exercise or anything like that. So it's a little bit hard to say, well, what happens if you overlay exercise on top of that? But, you know, some rodent models have shown that, you know, when you put mice in like alternate day fasting, so that's a different model of energy deficit, but it's energy deficit, with or without exercise, and also compared to like a control and a control with exercise as well, and control is ad libitum feeding, that the mice that exercise, of course, they become fitter, right? Like, but you have an exercise group and an exercise and energy deficit group, and the exercise and energy deficit group, after 8 weeks, they perform better on a treadmill time to fatigue, and they have higher markers of mitochondrial biogenesis and mitochondria than the mice that were only exercising, sort of suggesting that exercise or let's say energy deficit overlaid on top of exercise might give you that sort of maybe extra little bit of like a stimulus for the muscle to sort of generate energy. That's a rodent model, and you know we're quite different from rodents, so that's why we conducted this study, that we were trying to look at what happens when you overlay an energy deficit on top of individuals that exercise, and that's the study that we did that you were asking about before. And in this study, we exposed individuals to a sort of these studies are very, very hard to conduct because we control for so many variables. And I mean, you deal with humans all the time, and this is quite hard to study humans because they are humans and they like to do whatever they like to do. It's not like a rodent that you bring in the lab and you just, you know, make exercise and feed them whenever you want and so on. So we kind of try to do that, you know, but with the limitations that entails. And so in this study, we exposed our participants. So we recruited 10 young, healthy, untrained, they were trained individuals to 3 times or like three periods of 5 days each in the following order. The first 5 days, they were in, we didn't control their exercise or nutrition. We just left them in sort of free living conditions. Then we exposed them to 5 days of an energy balance diet with exercise. So they were doing 3 times about 90 minutes of exercise at 60% of VO2 max. Everything was like quantified to the nearest calorie. So they came to the lab, they exercised in our labs. We gave them all the food in like sort of pre-packaged meals and so on. And the same thing we did for the last 5 day period, where we exposed them to a pronounced reduction in energy of around 78% of energy reduction and they kept exercising the same, and they ate, of course, a lot less. We reduced each macronutrient by the same sort of percentage. So the percentage contribution of energy was 60% from carbohydrates, 20% from fat, and 20% from protein. And we reduced everything in the same amount. So we didn't try to feed them a higher sort of protein diet or anything like that, even though, like, we know if we wanted to maintain their sort of muscle mass and stuff like that, that we would do that. But that was not the point of the study. We were just looking at the energy. We reduced everything. That's kind of standard in these types of studies. So importantly, before and after each period, we took muscle biopsies from the quadriceps muscle, and we did an analysis of quite advanced molecular biology methodology, where we look at proteomics. Proteomics is the analysis of individual proteins in skeletal muscle. In particular, the technique that we use is called dynamic proteomic profiling, that allows us to see rates of protein synthesis of individual proteins, as well as abundance of the actual protein. So they are like sort of two separate analyses in muscle that should be telling you the same story. Of course, we did all the key assessments of like body composition and metabolism and endocrinology throughout the study. We took blood samples throughout the whole of the study, measured body weight, measured body composition with DEXA and bioelectrical impedance analysis. We did assessment of resting metabolic rate and so on. So that is the intervention that we did. You see, like, the intervention is rather short, but it's quite pronounced, the energy deficit, mainly because we wanted to look at and detect any differences in the response in the muscle. And sometimes if you do like a mild sort of intervention for a short period of time, you don't get to do that. And if you do an intervention that lasts for months and months, you don't have such good control of the intake and expenditure as we did. That's why the intervention is rather short. So do you want to know the results?
Yeah, please do. Please do.
Okay. If you give me the green light, I'll tell you the results. So what we found was quite fascinating. Of course, the intervention had the effect that we expected it to have. You know, individuals lost weight during the energy deficit period. There were no changes during the energy balance period. The weight loss was quite pronounced, was around 3 kilos of body weight. Around 900 grams was a loss of fat mass, and around 1.2 kilos of fat-free mass. And that fat-free mass, you know, people tend to think that, oh, that's muscle loss. Well, not necessarily. Fat-free mass, with the methodology we use to measure, and most methodologies that measure body composition don't give you specific information about where that is coming from. And actually, body water is typically measured, or is typically detected as a fat-free mass. And so we did an assessment of total body water by bioelectrical impedance analysis. And, you know, there was around 1.2 kilos of loss of body water. So when we're taking that into account and the energy equivalents of different tissues, the majority of energy, because, you know, you get so much energy in around a kilo of fat, the majority of the energy fueling that energy deficit was derived from the utilization of fat. So first thing, you know, the intervention had the effect that we expected it to have in terms of weight loss and so on. But also we were interested at looking at what happens with the endocrine responses in males to energy deficit, which there's not a lot of information about, because, you know, historically this topic has been, it's probably the only topic in nutrition and sports nutrition that's been more studied in females than in males. And as we expected, you know, we saw a decrease in sort of what we call like markers of energy preservation. So they're like endocrine markers that are sort of signaling that the body is going into an energy preservation state, like changes in hormone T3 and leptin and IGF-1 and P1 and P2 and so on. All these endocrine markers were moving in the direction that we would expect that the body is going, like, all right, there's an energy deficit. I need to adjust my physiology to this sort of new energetic state. We didn't see, however, any changes in resting metabolic rate, like absolute resting metabolic rate or relative resting metabolic rate. So relative to the fat-free mass, there were no changes or absolute in kilocalories per day throughout this period. But of course, we saw an increase in the contribution of fat during exercise and at rest during the energy deficit period. So all of this was kind of intuitive. We kind of like, you know, not intuitive, but it was based on like other evidence that, you know, suggested that that was what's going to happen. So, you know, again, the intervention had the effect that we intended, but the main result, the most interesting result, is the result related to what happened in skeletal muscle. Also, as we expected in skeletal muscle, there was a reduction of muscle glycogen. They were eating less carbohydrates because they were in an energy deficit state. But, you know, what was really, really interesting is that the muscle showed like two very distinct responses in terms of like the qualitative changes in the muscle. And that's why this technique that we use is so important, because it allows us to see the change in the quality of the muscle. So what we observed here first, when we look at the synthesis rates of the protein, so we measured around 700 proteins individually, that we can look at the rates of protein synthesis of these proteins. And we group them in different pools. So we look at the myofibrillar pool, which is the contractile part of the muscle. We look at the sarcoplasmic or pool, which is like the proteins that are sort of floating around in the muscle, for lack of a better word. And then we look at the mitochondrial pool of proteins. So the proteins that are specific to the mitochondria in the muscle. And throughout the whole intervention, there were no changes in the protein synthesis in the myofibrillar or sarcoplasmic pool, but there was an increase in the synthesis rates of the mitochondrial pool. So signaling that, you know, during the energy deficit period, that energy deficit overlaid on top of the exercise might be having an effect on the rates of synthesis of mitochondrial proteins. And we didn't only see changes in the rate of the mitochondrial proteins, but then we looked at the abundance of the protein. So the abundance is the result of the relationship between the synthesis and the breakdown of proteins. We saw that there was also an increase in the abundance of the proteins that we measured, increase in synthesis rates for, and many others, because the abundance analysis yields a lot more information. We had nearly 1,500 proteins that we measured in for this parameter. And we saw an increase in mitochondrial proteins of key pathways that are the beta oxidation, the tricarboxylic acid cycle, and the electron transport chain. So we are like important pathways of the mitochondria related to energy generation. But not only we saw an increase in mitochondrial protein pathways, proteins, but we also saw increase in proteins that are in charge of quality control of the mitochondria. So that was on itself like quite fascinating, and it kind of was in line with what we had hypothesized before, you know, what would happen in the study based on like rodent and studies in monkeys. But what was also really, really interesting is that as we saw an upregulation of those mitochondrial proteins, we saw a downregulation of proteins of the extracellular matrix. So the extracellular matrix is this scaffolding, so to speak, of a whole range of proteins that are around the muscle fibers that, you know, provide some sort of connection between the different muscle fibers. And, you know, they have a role in force transduction and so on. And it's composed mainly of collagen. But what we saw is that many proteins of this extracellular matrix, of this scaffolding, were reduced during the energy deficit period, which, you know, it's difficult to say if this is positive or this is negative outcome, But, you know, going back to the data that we saw in that sort of research in monkeys and what we know from this age-related fibrosis and accumulation of collagen with aging, that this reduction on key collagen-related proteins seem to be counteracting the effect of aging in these same proteins. So we saw a number of proteins that when we compare it to a database of aging muscle, that with aging, these proteins tend to increase. And as a consequence of our intervention, we saw these proteins decrease. So whether that is a positive or a negative outcome, we don't really know, but it's aligned with evidence shown in monkeys that muscle tend to not accumulate so much of these sort of collagen inclusions in muscle and might be related for the that the muscle can sort of maintain a better quality as it ages.
Excellent. Let me see if I am understanding it. And then I have a question for you that you haven't touched on, or if you did, I missed it. So we're talking about a short-term intervention as opposed to a long-term energy deficiency. It's a short-term one, but with exercise. So we're not talking about a fast where people are resting because, you know, they have low energy. And but even though they have an energy deficit, they're not moving and using their muscles. We're talking about where they are in a deficit and they are moving. So these are motivated people.
That's exactly right. And this is something that we need to highlight here. That is an intervention where there's not only an energy deficit, but that's got an exercise stimulus, and the outcomes probably would have been quite different if there was no exercise stimulus. We know, in fact, from long-term studies, by long-term, I mean like 6 months, 12 months interventions with energy deficit only versus energy deficit plus aerobic exercise or resistance exercise, that people tend to lose fitness when they do only a caloric restriction without inclusion of stimulus of any type of exercise, like resistance or training.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so in the short intervention with the exercise, the muscle fibers were not eaten away. They were retained. You had said that the muscle protein synthesis maintained, yes, even though there was a decrease in the amount of proteins that had been taken in. And I think you had said that, you know, indirectly, you had said that the fibers themselves seem to be, you know, the same, not the exact same atoms, but the amount of muscle fiber was the same before and after. So whether it was the same ones or some were destroyed and some were built, you know, in the end, it was the net the same. But on the other hand, the mitochondria increased. Now, I don't know if that adds up to something that is measurable or whether that was just the chemicals in the samples showed the hallmarks of more mitochondria being made, and even the quality control you mentioned, and maybe that's an autophagy kind of a thing, was increased, and that all of the energy came from fat burning, although a lot of the weight loss came from water loss also.
Yeah, so we didn't measure the amount of fibers. We know that like fiber count that's not tend to like change. What we measured was protein content, so protein synthesis on the one hand and protein abundance on the other hand. Of course, this doesn't give you an outcome, any functional outcome of the measurement. I cannot say from this data the mitochondria work at a faster rate, or this is related to an improvement in performance or anything like that. But we know that this is key machinery for the muscle to sort of generate energy. And typically, if you have more of that machinery, the muscle is better at doing that. So we have mechanistic data to support the idea that this might be related to potentially a positive outcome when it relates to energy production. But of course, we don't know that because we haven't measured that.
Okay. And so that was actually a question that I said I was going to ask and then didn't. And that was that, did you measure the performance of these athletes while they were exercising, you know, like power output per heartbeat or something, just to see, were they getting stronger? Like that woman in the women's Tour of France got stronger throughout the tour, or was that not measured?
No, that was not measured. The only thing that we assessed, of course, when they were exercising each day that they came into the lab, we put them at a steady state type exercise. So they always exercise at the same intensity, but we did not do any assessment of physical performance. It was not the aim of this study to see whether they can improve their performance with this type of intervention. We saw no changes in the rate of perceived exertion during exercise. It was not becoming harder as they, you know, progressed through the actual study. So in that sense, there were no actual changes, but we didn't do an assessment of any maximal capacity for performance. And of course, if we were to do that, we probably need to change the diet to make sure they have the fuel they need. And this is something that we need to be aware of, that, you know, if you put someone on an energy deficit diet, as we said before, like the muscle glycogen tends to decrease. And we know since like the 60s that a decrease in muscle glycogen is very much related and most likely a cause of an incapacity to perform exercise at a higher intensity. So this is something that you have to be aware of if you're going to go into any degree of energy deficit, that your muscle glycogen stores most likely are going to suffer, and then your performance is likely going to suffer at least as a consequence of that. So you got to be aware that there's a sort of systemic response to energy deficit, this endocrine response to energy deficit, you know, related to a range of physiological responses as well. But there's also an acute sort of localized energy depletion as well, specifically in muscle, a reduction in muscle glycogen. And this is very, very, very likely to have a negative effect on performance. So you need to take care of that before you test for performance.
Okay. And so even though you didn't actually measure any performance improvement or even, you know, degrading a performance in the study, you had spoken about earlier in our talk about the fighters who had to make weight and how they got stronger throughout a longer period of time. And probably what would, and even with those guys, it's my understanding that there's a decent gap between their weigh-in and when they fight. So they have time to recover and recover their glycogen stores, like you're describing, so that their performance is not significantly undermined by their efforts to make their weight. So probably, if the calorie deficit, the energy stress combined with the exercise is having some positive effect on the infrastructure, right? I'm building more mitochondria, I'm maybe getting rid of bad mitochondria, quality control. When I refeed, I'm getting some kind of a extra benefit, at least just refueling the storage of fuel in my muscles, but perhaps something else. Maybe I'm getting a kind of a rebound in my my mTOR. I'm getting a growth signal to respond to, you know, this stress, this combined stress of low calorie and high effort. Does that make any sense? Do you think that's right?
I don't think that I would conclude necessarily that there's a sort of like rebound effect in like sort of anabolic response or anything like that. I am not aware that that's the case. I think the main thing here is that, you know, what we are talking about is something that is a quite fine balance. So I need to clarify that it's not that I'm advocating for a chronic energy deficit or energy deficit in any way to improve adaptation to training. Maybe the take home message here is that with a degree of energy deficit, your body seems to be able to adapt to training, but we need to be careful, and we don't need to make energy deficit a priority. As I was saying before, there's a lot of other things that people probably need to do before thinking about going to any degree of energy deficit, also because it's quite complex. We're talking specifically about muscle here, and so we also need to take into consideration that we are not just made of muscle, right? We've got bones as well, and we know that, you know, energy deficit seems to have a negative effect on sort of bone formation in particular, maybe bone resorption as well. And if you are working with sort of aging population, particularly females that, you know, might have gone through menopause and they have like lower levels of estrogen and so on, that the bones might be weaker. And so introducing the effect of an energy deficit stress for this specific population in terms of the functioning of their bones might not be ideal, and you need to be thinking about supplementing the whatever aerobic exercise they might be doing with some degree of weight training, potentially, to keep their bones stronger.
Okay, well, fair warning. Thanks on that. I just actually personally finished doing a fasting mimicking diet, which is also a 5-day intervention, and it's designed to mimic like a 3 or 4 day water fast, but with the advantage of not losing lean mass. But they don't advocate doing any exercise, you know, because I think the combination of the lower calories, because it gets down to like 800 calories a day, and I assure you that is not very much, that also exercising would be very stressful, and, you know, and they don't want to get sued. I tend to always exercise anyway, and yes, I'm very depleted at the end, but I always seem to get significant benefits from it. But they also say that people will not lose muscle in their 5-day, even though they're not exercising. But what I actually believe that that's what their science says. But in any case, the reason I mention it is because what they probably are not getting, the people doing that, me when I did that, if I wasn't exercising, is I'm not getting that stimulus to make more mitochondria, which is really one of my top goals. I had a conversation with Mark Tarnopolsky, who researches mitochondria, and he said that, because I said, hey, how do I get mitochondria other places in my body? You know, I know about my muscles. And he says, if you are exercising and getting mitochondria in your muscles, you get mitochondria everywhere. So then this stimulus that you're describing that is encouraging mitochondria in my muscles, which I like, it's a good thing, I think, maybe it's also encouraging me to be more efficient and better at making energy elsewhere, making my body function better. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, there's some really interesting work by Mark Matson, which I think he's in Johns Hopkins there in the US, and they've shown that energy deficit can potentially have an effect in promoting mitochondrial biogenesis in neurons as well, which I think is quite fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, cool. Well, you know, what's something that popped into my head that maybe you can help me with is, you know, I'm in a deficit for energy, you know, because of the way that you did it. I'm in a deficit for protein, and I mentioned the fasting mimicking. They definitely like cut all the protein out, because what they're after is an autophagy benefit. And so they're trying to provide no signal to cells to, you know, have mTOR turn on and turn off autophagy. But where does the protein come from for making these mitochondria if I'm not eating it?
Yeah, so the mitochondrial pool in muscle is quite small, actually, compared to the rest of the rest of the pools. And there's this circulating amino acids all the time in the muscle that seem to be enough to synthesize mitochondria. In fact, you know, there's been some older research that's looked at, you know, only not to the granularity that we had in this study, which makes this study quite unique, that we look at individual proteins, but they looked at, you know, sarcoplasmic, myofibrillar, and mitochondrial pools, protein synthesis as a result of like exercise and exercise plus protein, and protein intake doesn't seem to maximize the mitochondrial protein synthesis. And it's hypothesized that because the amino acid pool you have enough amino acids circulating to synthesize the amount of proteins you might need for such a small protein pool, because compared to the, let's say, myofibrillar pool, which is the bulk of the muscle in terms of size, it needs more protein maybe than the mitochondrial pool.
I didn't know that. Thank you. Okay, so what do you think? Maybe this would be speculation. Maybe somebody's done this study, but maybe it's just speculation. But what would have been different, do you think, if instead of cycling 3 times for 90 minutes, I think you said, that if they were weightlifting, they were trying to build muscle rather than an endurance type of exercise?
Yeah, definitely the response would have probably been different. We don't know for sure, because this is the first time that we look at the muscle with this degree of detail in, you know, combination of exercise and energy deficit. What we know from sort of longer term studies, typically that's the other thing, that the majority of the studies that have done a degree of energy deficit and exercise is typically with overweight and obese populations, which it's understandable, provided that, you know, the overweight and obesity are like, obesity is a bit of a silent epidemic kind of thing, and we need to understand, you know, how to fix that better. But there's not enough research in like the healthy state. We're studying the disease state kind of thing. So to what extent these findings are applicable to like healthy, active people, I'm not 100% sure. But what we know is that if you do weights type training for a prolonged period of time, like 6 to 12 months of energy deficit, that you tend to retain better sort of this fat-free mass, this muscle. So what I would expect to see is more an increase in the myofibrillar fraction rather than the mitochondrial fraction, because we also know if you don't do a stimulus that is specific to aerobic type training, your VO2 max, for example, does not increase, and actually it tends to decrease a little bit with energy deficit, at least the absolute, maybe not relative to body weight, because your body weight is being decreased as well. But the phenotype of the muscle, so the visible characteristics of the muscle are specific to the type of stimulus that you give to the muscle.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the lack of proteins, or, you know, shortage of proteins in the diet, would maybe be overcome with the scavenging of, you know, older proteins, or maybe I don't even need that much.
Yeah. I think that's something we need to be aware of, is that, you know, people are so fixated in looking good and, you know, having big muscles. But what we need to think about more is about the functional outcomes. We know that you can increase strength without your muscle massively increasing in size. And in fact, there's studies showing that when you put people over, you know, on energy deficit over a period of like 8 to 12 weeks or something like that, and you put them to do resistance type exercise and energy deficit, that you might not have the same gains in muscle mass, but you have the same gains in strength. And again, these are not elite athletes, but we need to be focusing more on function rather than form, right? I think people are like really concerned about their muscles, like being lean and looking, you know, like they have like big muscles and so on. But, you know, understandably so, people are concerned about their aesthetics, but we need to think about this in like functional terms. And it's very clear that you can get fitter, you can get stronger without your muscles increasing in size. And relative to your body weight, also your strength tends to increase regardless of you are in an energy deficit or not.
I think that's a very important point. Thank you for making that. I personally suffer from, you know, a dysmorphia, you know, where I've got to be bigger. I want bigger muscles, or I don't look good, kind of a thing. But the older I get, the harder that is. And also the more I'm focusing on capacity, on function, in as broad a range as possible. You know, if I'm just lifting weights, then I'm
not going to be good at a lot of things. And if I'm just riding a bike and lifting weights, there's still a lot of things I'm not going to be good at. So I have to spread my efforts out. But one of the things, I'll wrap up with this. One of the things that is just a conundrum to me, it's been killing me really trying to solve this problem. And that is that I've been convinced by people that if I'm going to build muscle or hold on to my muscle, I have to eat a lot of protein, which leads me to eat more in general. And I need a calorie surplus, quote unquote, in order to be able to build muscle. And you can't build muscle only, you're going to build muscle with a little bit of body fat. And then that sets me up for, well, how do I lose the body fat once I've gained it? Because I don't want, fat in my organs and maybe in my muscles, interfering with these functions that I'm trying to make more youthful. There's two things here that I thought about first when I first heard about your work, which was one was, hey, I can do this dieting, I can do this calorie deficit and not lose my capabilities, because his guys did not lose their muscles when they were losing weight and losing fat. The fat was the main thing. But the second thought I had is, so respond to both of these things if you can. Maybe what I really needed to focus on was not having a calorie surplus, that I could get stronger without the calorie surplus. Then I didn't need to worry about losing the fat later. What do you think about that?
The typical protein recommendations for athletic population say that you should be ingesting somewhere between 1.2 and 1.6 grams per kilo of protein per day. If you go into an energy deficit, we know that you tend to lose, fat-free mass. And if you want to retain that fat-free mass or that muscle, that you need that resistance-type stimulus, as well as increasing protein intake to around 2.2 grams per kilo per day. If you think that energy is coming from protein and not from fat or carbohydrates and so on, it's not really a really high increase in energy intake that you need from that sort of increased protein intake. So that shouldn't be a problem. And the degree of energy deficit that you have is going to be key in having an effect on your capacity to build muscle. As I was making reference to before, this meta-analysis showing that if you have more of a 500 kilocalories per day energy deficit, your muscles tend to, not grow in response to resistance training type effort. And of course, you can offset that a little bit by increasing the protein intake, as I was mentioning before. But yeah, you can definitely get leaner and grow your muscles at the same time.
Okay, well, that is really good. I think that's what I'm going to try to do is try to do less over calorie and then under calorie. But I am going to continue with my efforts to do, essentially what you did in your project that I do with my fasting mimicking diet, but I also exercise while I do that. And I'm doing both resistance training and endurance work.
Yeah, I think that's the key sort of, from the other research that we know in this area, that to maintain function, if you're going to have an energy deficit, you need to maintain the sort of exercise stimulus. And of course, we didn't test that in this study because there was no group or intervention with no exercise and energy deficit. But we know from longitudinal studies that, go for 6 to 12 months and so on, that you need that stimulus to maintain the functional capacity, which is the most important thing.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, Dr. Arruda, thank you for this and for your work. Tell our audience how they can find you. I'll put a link to the study in the show notes, but if there's anything else that they should look for, please let us know.
Yeah, so I am on different sort of social media platforms, more or less active in different ones. I am on LinkedIn. That's more, it's got more a professional sort of flavor to it. And I also used to use more like Twitter, now X, but I think it's not the best environment for academics there anymore. And I recently opened an Instagram account where I try to share, you know, quality information in a social media platform that seems to be needing a more quality information, because there's a lot of misinformation there. But I think there's a capacity for it to maybe reach more people there. So I'm starting to share more in that platform as well.
What's your handle there?
It's my name, Jose, / L for Lisandro is my second name. Underscore. Jose _ L _ Areta, my surname. So you can find me there. And I've been trying to make a little bit of content there on the side. You can also find me on ResearchGate, you know, where my scientific publications are uploaded when they are available, but at least the links are put there. And those are the main places I think you can find me. And of course, you've got a university website. Soon I will have my own website. I think that should be enough for people to be able to find me for now. And there's, you know, I've done loads of podcasts and there's videos of me in YouTube talking about these and other topics. So if you type my name in any of these platforms, you'll definitely find it.
Excellent. Dr. Areta, thank you again. I'll put as much of this as I can find in the show notes and people can just click instead of having to do searches. But thank you again.
Thank you for the invitation, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining my talk with Dr. Jose Areta. You can find more information about Dr. Areta in the show notes.